Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rick Haefeli, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the most common nymph fishing mistakes. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rick Haefeli about the most common nymph fishing mistakes. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the support that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Rick, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. If you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rick's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rick's book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers, and Streams, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And here's how you can win Rick's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something Rick and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Rick's book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers, and Streams. Well, tonight our guest is Rick Haefeli. Rick caught his first trout on a fly at the age of 12 on a spring creek in Missouri. His interest in fly fishing and aquatic insects fully developed after he moved to the Pacific Northwest in 1969. Since then, he has traveled throughout the West and beyond, fishing for wild native trout and collecting and studying the insects upon which they feed. Rick has a Master of Science degree in aquatic entomology from Oregon State University and has worked as a professional aquatic biologist for over 30 years, specializing in water quality assessment using aquatic insects. Rick has written articles for scientific journals and penned for the aquatic entomology column for American Angler magazine for over 30 years. Books to his credit include An Angler's Guide to Aquatic Insects and Their Imitations, The Complete Book of Western Hatches, Western Mayfly Hatches, and most recently, Nymph Fishing, Rivers, and Streams. He is also instructed in 8 fly fishing DVDs, starting with the 1983 Scientific Angler release of Anatomy of a Trout Stream. His most recent DVD, Advanced Tactics for Emergers and Dries, was just released by Laughing River Productions in 2011. And I know he's got a more current one, which he's going to tell us about soon. Rick is currently a member of the Freshwater Trust, Native Fish Society of Oregon, the Western River Conservancy and Water Watch. He is also awarded life membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fishers Club of Oregon, for his contributions to fly fishing literature. He lives in Portland, Oregon, with his wife, Carol. Rick, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. It's great to be back, and I really appreciate all the introduction and stuff. Thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. No problem. You've got a lot to be proud of. And, boy, you sure got the audience going this past couple of weeks by sending in a lot of questions. How did you put it, Rick, when I told you about how many questions there were?
I said, well, either nymph fishing is really popular or really confusing or both. But that's a great question.
Yeah, so I think the answer is both. Because, boy, did our audience turn out the questions. And we'll have a tough time getting through them, but we'll do our best here. Rick had really five different areas that he felt were areas that he wanted to cover where he saw the majority of mistakes being made. And so we're going to run through those five scenarios and Rick's answers to those. And then we'll jump into all your questions that you folks nicely sent in, and we've got a ton of them. So let's get going, Rick. We'll have to move fast to cover, I don't know, I got like six pages of questions here. So the first one up is on your list, as you said, don't be afraid to use small nymph patterns. So tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's one of the things that I think is most striking when I've done classes and gone out collecting in streams to look at the insects and then look at people's nymph patterns they have in their fly box. And undoubtedly, if you start putting your nymph patterns in a tray with the live insects that you're most often imitating, they stand out as being much larger than the naturals. And it sort of makes sense. I have some of the same tendency to put on a large nymph because it seems logical that fish are going to respond to a bigger piece of food than a smaller piece, and you think subconsciously they're going to see the bigger piece of food easier than the small piece of food. Unfortunately, trout don't behave that way most of the time. Big flies work, there's no question about it, but 90% of the time in a typical trout stream, those trout are feeding on food items that are pretty darn small. And over the years, I've found over and over again by going to smaller size nymphs, my success goes up. And by small, I mean size 16s and smaller. 16s, 18s, and 20s are the sizes I use the most of the time. And nymph fishing anywhere, it doesn't matter whether I'm in Montana or Wisconsin or Chile, the trout most often respond to these small foods really, really well. Doesn't mean you're always going to be doing that, but people almost always err on the side of using bigger patterns. And if you're not having luck, go down in size.
Interesting. We always think big is better because, you know, you think big catches larger fish, but
And we pay close attention to size when we're dry fly fishing, and we're kind of schooled on the idea that you want your pattern to match the size of the natural when fish are feeding on dry flies. And you can see the fly, you might catch one, and you look closely at the size and pick a pattern as close as possible. But nymph fishing, we almost never get our hands on the real thing, and so we don't tend to pay as close attention to size. I asked Charlie Brooks years ago, for those who know who Charlie Brooks was, passed away many years ago, but he lived in West Yellowstone, wrote the book Nymph Fishing for Larger Trout, which is still one of my favorite books on nymph fishing. And I asked him in an interview, much like this almost, about his impression on size. And he had the same response as that, don't be afraid to put on small nymphs. Size is really important to nymph fishing success. So,
okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay, second one up is avoid rootitis.
Rootitis. Yeah, rootitis is...
Rootitis.
is a name I've given to what I see people doing on streams that are nymphing. Again, it comes down to the problem with nymph fishing that you don't see the fish. And so you're not sure how they're reacting to you when you're fishing. When you're dry fly fishing, you're casting over one or more fish that you see feeding. And you know when you've sort of put them down, if you've spooked them and they've moved off, and you know then it's time to move to a different piece of water where maybe other fish are working and you haven't disturbed them. But with nymph fishing, you have no idea if you've disturbed a group of fish or not because you can't see them most of the time. And you might be in a spot that looks extremely fishy. And so you're set up there, you've got, you know, good patterns on, you're ready to go, and you start casting, and you just feel confident that there's fish there, and so you stay there a long time. And by a long time, I've seen people along a stretch of stream on the Deschutes where I fish a lot in Oregon, where I've driven by, and an hour later, they're within 5 feet of the same place that they had been nymphing. And you go down and talk to them and usually say, well, it's been really slow. And the whole problem there, one of the problems certainly, is that they need to keep moving to get your fly in front of a different group of fish. Either the fish that you're right out near you have been spooked and moved off, or they're just not feeding. And so this is why I call it rootitis. It's like your feet are stuck in one place and you aren't moving. The solution to that, in my mind, is to really do a thorough job of covering a piece of water with, I always tell people, 8 to 10 good drifts through a very specific piece of water. Maybe it's a slot that's, you know, 10 feet out from you. And if you don't get any response in 8 or 10 drifts through that slot, then move your fly to a different little piece of section of stream. Maybe it's 2 feet further out, 2 feet upstream, or 10 feet upstream, but you're moving the fly to a different section of stream. You're not just covering that one piece of water over and over and over. And I move pretty quickly when I nymph fish through a section of stream. But you're continually then getting your fly out there in front of more fish. And with nymphing, that's always, I think, beneficial.
And if, I know we're going to, well, let's just leave this till later, because I know there's a lot of questions about waiting.
Yeah, yeah.
Waiting here and being, are you deep enough or aren't you deep enough? And I think that's always the question if you're not catching fish is if you are or aren't. We got a whole section on that coming up. So, okay,
yeah.
Third, change patterns that aren't working.
Yeah, this is kind of related to rootitis. You know, that old saying, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And so if you're out there and you've been fishing for an hour or more and haven't had any success, you need to really consider what you're doing and change something. And one of the things with nymph fishing, certainly, that would make sense to change is your fly patterns. Again, we have favorite patterns. Everybody that's been fishing for a while has some favorite patterns that they have a lot of confidence in. And so you're likely to go out there, if you don't have any particular reason to choose one fly over another, you put on one of those favorite patterns. And that's always, you know, that's probably a good place to start if they've been successful in the past. But if you aren't having success with them on that day, change your flies. And it's just like changing the little section of water you're fishing. You're going to move to a spot where you haven't covered the water yet. You're going to also, if you're not having success, want to look at the patterns you're using. So if I've been fishing a set of flies for, golly, you know, like an hour, I'm really going to be, you know, looking at changing patterns. And I might change them more often than that if I think there's a good reason. Like I start seeing some different insect activity going on that wasn't earlier, then I might, you know, be changing sooner too. But I see people using the same nymph patterns all day long. And they, you know, are saying, well, I didn't have a very good day today. So you really need to, you know, consider what patterns you have on and don't keep using the same ones if they aren't working.
Okay, number four. Get your nymphs to the bottom.
Yeah, with nymph fishing, so there's nymphing when there's a hatch going on and you see insects coming off and you see maybe some subsurface feeding activity. In those situations, you're not always trying to get your nymphs to the bottom. But most of the time when we're nymph fishing, we're nymphing specifically because there are no insects hatching and the river looks pretty, you know, dead, you might say, or quiet. There's just not any fish activity. So we put on nymphs. And in those situations, which are my experience most of the time when I'm nymphing, you want your nymph patterns right along the bottom. And that's one of the bigger challenges with nymph fishing, really, is getting a rig set up. And I know there's quite a few questions we've got about rigging. But getting your rig set up so your flies will get to the bottom and that you can still detect strikes. But as far as getting to the bottom, when I'm not trying to fish my mid-water, I want to be feeling my nymphs ticking the bottom and maybe even catching on a rock. Every 5 or 6 casts, if I don't feel the bottom with my nymphs, I'm going to put on more weight to get them down. I've actually fished through a, you know, 100 feet or 200 feet of water and have caught 0 fish, gone back to the bottom and added one or two more split shot fish through that same water and hooked 8 or 10 fish. And all I did different was put on more weight. So if the fish aren't moving for insects, they're generally going to be really close to the bottom, and that's where you want to get your nymphs.
Okay, good. And number 5, fish nymphs with as little line as possible.
Yeah, as short a cast as possible. And, you know, the things with nymph fishing are, A, kind of getting a fly pattern that the fish are, you know, looking for, what kind of meets some of the insect life that's in the streams, understanding what that might be, getting your flies to the bottom, and then detecting strikes. That's the other big challenge with nymph fishing, is knowing when you actually have a strike. And with all the techniques out there for nymphing, whether it's high sticking or with an indicator, shot and indicator, or check nymphing, all those different techniques are really trying, more than anything, is to help you detect a strike. And you're going to improve your chances with any of those techniques by using a shorter amount of line out on the water as opposed to longer. And so sometimes you're going to end up, if you're fishing a relatively good-sized stream and you can't wade closer to some of the water you want to fish, yeah, you're going to be casting 15, 20 feet of fly line, which for me, 20 feet of fly line is a lot of fly line on the water when I'm nymphing. Most of the time I want 10 feet or less of line out there, and often it's almost right under the rod tip. So you're just going to be much more in touch with both feel and vision to see what's going on. Whether you're using an indicator or not, that shorter amount of line on the water is going to improve your success significantly. And interestingly enough, I think that's why a lot of the guides that are out there with anglers who are just starting will set them up with nymphs, because they don't have to cast very far at all to be successful at nymph fishing. All they have to do is flip out 5 feet of fly line, and you can catch fish very effectively that way with nymphing. But if they aren't effective casters and there's, you know, fishing dries, you might need to cast 30, 40 feet or further. And if you're not, you know, skilled enough to do that well, then you're going to have problems. But nymphing is not about casting. It's about really getting your flies in the right place and detecting that strike.
Okay. Coming in off the internet here, Rem Harris in Cleveland has rooditis. He's sharing that with the world. And
I like it.
So you've come out there, Rem, and we know that you've got rooditis, and we know it's a problem for you. But he wants you to share some more thoughts on that. He says, okay, so if he's in stuck in one spot, how long do you work that section if you're changing flies? And would you recommend another 8 to 10 drifts with new patterns in the same spot? And I would add to that, would you do another 8 to 10 drifts with more weight before you left that spot? You really have, like, 3 scenarios there.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And the way I approach it is I'm kind of looking at a reach of stream when I walk down and start nymphing. And that reach, you know, is going to vary with the type of stream you're on. But say it's a couple of hundred feet that looks like water that's worth your time. And so you're going to start, when I nymph fish, I start at the bottom and I work upstream. And I'm casting up and across at some angle or other to get the right drift. And casting upstream also helps your flies sink more quickly, so that helps them get to the bottom. So I'm going to start at the bottom of that section of stream, and I'm going to start working upstream. And I'm going to, you know, sort of set up with the amount of weight that I hope will get to the bottom. But I'm going to know pretty quickly if I don't have enough weight on, because I'll know my flies after half a dozen casts. If I don't feel them ticking the bottom a little bit, then I'll know I need to add more weight. So I'll adjust that right away if I'm not getting deep enough. Usually what I've done before I even put my nymphs on, I'm going to spend 15, 20 minutes picking up some rocks and looking at what the natural insects are out there. And this doesn't require, you know, a degree in entomology. All you're really trying to do is get a sense of the size and what kind of critters are abundant. So I'm probably going to have a fly pattern on that I feel has a chance of matching some of the natural insects out there on that particular day and stretch of river. So I'm starting at the bottom with some patterns I feel pretty good about. And then I'm going to work up through that piece of water fishing individual little spots. So I try to visualize holding lies underwater by just looking at the current seams and character of the water on the surface, trying to visualize where there's holding water and places fish will be sitting on the bottom. And I cast to specific spots while I'm nymphing. So I'll cast, you know, 5 feet above a particular little swirl behind a boulder or a current seam along a piece of water that changes depth. And I'm getting a drift through that very specific spot. And I don't, you know, worry if I don't get a strike. I certainly fish the cast out. But I'm really focused on getting a fish to strike in that spot, almost like if I had seen a fish rising in that spot. And that's the place where I'm trying to get 8 or 10 good drifts, right through that very defined area that I think there's a fish holding. And after 8 or 10 casts through that very defined location, I'm going to move either my cast further out, or I'm going to walk upstream 5 paces or 3 paces, wherever that next really fishy-looking little current seam is to me. And I'll work that whole 200 feet of water that way, adjusting weight as I need to keep my flies on the bottom, and probably adjusting the distance of my indicator from my flies if I'm using an indicator. And then at the end of that 200 feet, if I haven't, and it might take me 2 hours, it might take me hour and a half, hour to 2 hours to work through that, depending how many fish I'm hooking or not hooking, the fish stay 200 or 300 feet of stream reach. And then I'll go back to the bottom if I think I really fished through there and I didn't catch anything. Go, wow, you know, I should be changing flies. Or I might change halfway through that run if I really feel like, you know, this just isn't working. So I'd probably fish those flies I put on initially for a half an hour, 45 minutes before I start changing them. But I'm moving through there pretty consistently a little bit at a time after 8 or 10 drifts through a piece of defined water.
Good, good. That's a very good overview. So we need to take a quick break here, Rick. We'll be right back.
Okay.
And when we do, we'll dive into more of these questions.
Great.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Haefeli about the most common nymph fishing mistakes. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Rick, what new projects have you been working on in the fly fishing world?
Well, the main thing, actually, Roger, is Dave Hughes and Skip Morris and I have been doing a online newsletter for a little over 2 years, almost 2.5 years, and we've kind of given that up, for better or for worse. But the good news is that the material we've done, put together for that newsletter is going to be made into 2 different books by Stackpole. So we're right now working, just kind of finishing up all the material and sending it in to Stackpole. So next year, in 2014, there's going to be 2 books coming out by the 3 of us. And the names of the books haven't been really locked in stone yet, but one's going to be on specifically on tactics, and the other's going to be on seasonal changes that occur through the season of fishing. So that's going to be fun to see that all put together in book form.
Good, good. Yeah, that sounds like an exciting project. Yeah, and the 3 of you, wow, what a wealth of knowledge. Sounds
like
more interviews for us.
Thank you.
Well, we got a question relating to your top 5 here. John Wheatley in Glen Ellen, Illinois, wrote in and asked, what is the biggest mistake you see fishermen repeatedly make? Is it one of those top 5? One big one?
It is. It is, and I'd say the biggest mistake is using flies that are too big.
Okay.
Nymph patterns that are too big. Look in your fly box, your nymph fly box, and if you don't have a good selection of nymphs in 16s, 18s, and 20s, start tying some or go buy some.
Okay, okay. Rod in Portland, Oregon asks, what is one of your biggest aha moments when it comes to nymph fishing?
Oh, that's a good, that's very, very good one and very clear in my mind. The aha moment was when I do a fair bit of snorkeling, put on a wetsuit and a mask and snorkel and hang out in trout streams over the years. And I was fishing a stream. This was actually in Chile. Not that that mattered, but Dave Hughes and I were down there, and it was perfectly good situation, really clear water. There was a lot of trout. And I was down hanging out in this moderately deep run. It was probably about 4 feet deep. And Dave was nymph fishing, and I could see his nymphs drifting clearly, and I could watch the fish and react to his flies. And my aha moment was that, I kid you not, every cast Dave made, he had at least one and sometimes two or three fish pick up his nymph and spit it out. He had no clue, absolutely zero clue that this was going on. And I attribute it to nymph's lousy nymph fishing technique, but no, actually, that's what I kidded him about. But actually, he wouldn't have been able to tell this. And so my aha moment was that, hey, when you're nymph fishing, you need to do everything you can to feel those strikes, and you're still going to be missing fish that are picking up your fly and spitting it out. It's just going to be happening. But whatever you can do to improve your sensitivity to strikes is going to help. And the reason he wasn't feeling it is that there was just a bit of slack. He was using an indicator, but at some point in those drifts, there was some slack leader between his indicator and the fly. So even though the fish maybe jiggled his leader a little bit, it never jiggled the indicator. So he had no way of knowing. And those fish can suck in your nymph and spit it out faster than you can see it. So that was my real aha moment about nymphing.
So we have more takes than we ever know about.
You have more takes than you know about, and, you know, it relates to a question that's somewhere on the list was about how do you know when your indicator has been moved by a fish? And that the guy said a guide was always asking him to set the hook, you know, yelling at him to set the hook, and he wasn't setting it. And that is really key, because when I work with people nymphing, I say set the hook at least once every drift. Every cast you make, set the hook at least once. And people look at me like, well, really? You think I'm getting a strike every drift? And what I want them to do is to watch that indicator, if they're using one, so closely that any little tiny wiggle or unusual slowing down or subtle movement, you want to set the hook. And it doesn't mean ripping the line out of the water and making your back cast over your head. It just means lifting up and tightening on your line to see if there's resistance, and then you can, you know, if you're using small flies, you're going to set the hook pretty easily. But that, people will start catching fish nymphing more from just that one suggestion, just about anything else, because they're just letting it drift when they're getting strikes and they didn't know it. They had no clue it was a strike.
Okay, from John in Maine, I'm not sure which it is. He says, what's the easiest way to get started nymphing with success and not get frustrated for anglers new to the technique? He says, I'm looking for something like Introduction to Nymphing 101. And so maybe you can kind of answer John's question really succinctly, and then because then we're going to dive into nymph fishing 501 here next. So.
Yeah, I think probably the easiest thing to do would be to go with a single nymph setup, so you're not trying to use multiple flies. And you're going to want to put depending on the stream, but most any stream situation, you're going to want to put a split shot on to help your fly get to the bottom, unless it's an extremely heavily weighted nymph. So say you're going to put on a size 14 or 16 hare's ear, which I'll throw out just because it's a good all-around nymph pattern. You're going to put a bit of split shot, maybe 8 inches up from that fly. And it could be, you know, whatever type of weight you like. It could be putty or split shot, whatever you want to use. And then I would recommend, if you're beginning, and this is good for anybody, I mean, I use it all the time as an indicator, and put that indicator about twice the depth of the water you're fishing away from your fly. So if you're 2 feet of water, put that indicator about 4 feet from the fly. And just give that a good chance to work for you. That would be the rig I'd start with for somebody just starting out.
Okay, great. Okay, now the rest of these questions I've kind of broken into different groups, and one of the bigger groups was tandem rigs. So we'll work our way through these questions, and I'm sure we'll have some overlap here, but figure that out as we go. Ken in New Boston, Texas, says, do you recommend using one nymph at a time or a double? If using a single, do you use additional weight, and if so, how far from the nymph?
I do recommend using two flies. I fish most all the time when I'm nymphing with two nymph patterns on. There are some places where that's illegal. In Oregon, I'm pretty close to British Columbia, and I like to go up there and fish. And it's illegal in British Columbia to fish with two flies. You can fish with two rods at a time, funny, interesting enough, but not two flies. So if you go to British Columbia, don't put on two nymphs. You'll be breaking the law. The only place I've run into it, but there's probably some other places around where that may be true. If it's not illegal, though, definitely I think fishing two patterns, two nymph patterns, is more effective. Partly because you do end up having some weight, additional weight when you do that on your leader, so things are sinking a little quicker. But also, I think I've had situation, I've done this enough now, where I've had fish pretty good success fishing the rig I've got on, and I'm catching fish on one of the two flies consistently. It's just one of them. So I've gotten snagged, and I've lost some flies, the rig. So when I re-rig, I just put on that one fly instead of two because I'm catching all the fish on that single fly anyway. And lo and behold, the success rate goes way down. And then I put two flies back on. And again, I've added extra weight. So if I'm using a single fly, you do want to add extra weight. Part of that question, you always want to get enough weight to get that fly to the bottom, whether it's one or two. So I put on extra weight with the single, and again, it just wasn't as successful. I put two flies back on again, and boom, the success rate goes up. So I think what's happening is there is something to the fish getting more attention to what's drifting downstream when there's more than one nymph drifting by itself, and then they may be reacting more favorably to one of the patterns or the other, but two patterns together attract more attention from fish. That's my theory. And I've had that happen more often than once. And so I do like to use two nymphs.
Yeah, I think Ralph Cutter was saying something about that, too, when he was doing, you know, some underwater work, is that he saw fish move on that first fly and then take the second fly. And, like, got impressed or something. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Okay, next one I'm going to skip for the moment here. Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington. Brodin, do you like putting the heavier nymph on the bottom or putting it first with maybe a lighter-coated fiskant fly behind it?
I put the heavier nymph on first, and then I'll have the smaller nymph trailing behind the larger one. And partly because I know the smaller nymph is not going to sink as well, so I want the heavier nymph to help get everything down, and that'll keep the smaller nymph in a deeper zone than it might otherwise if it was the first fly. So I do like putting the heavier nymph on first. His comment about desiccant came up in another question too. And most of the time when I'm nymphing, I don't necessarily put desiccant on the nymphs because I want them really to get to the bottom. I think that's the key. And, you know, the materials we use nowadays have a lot of flash to them, even if you're, you know, just using some Antron material in the fly body and stuff. There's usually some nice sparkle to a lot of our nymphs. So I don't want to add something that's going to keep them from sinking. I want these flies to sink quickly. So I don't typically put desiccant on when I'm just standard nymphing. I do use desiccant when I'm fishing nymphs subsurface during a hatch, and I'm not trying to get them to the bottom. Maybe I'm just fishing them mid-depth or 6 inches deep or a foot deep, then I definitely like to put that desiccant on the nymph patterns to add that extra sparkle from air that's trapped on them.
Okay. Well, let's see. Steve Goodchild in the United Kingdom. He says, why do you catch more fish or takes on your second or third droppers as opposed to your end or lead fly?
Yeah. I think it kind of goes back to what we're alluding to with the multiple fly rigs is that the multiple fly sort of catches the attention of the fish, and then usually my trailing flies are the smaller patterns. And so, I mean, you could interpret it, that's part of the rationale that I think small patterns are really effective, because that trailing fly is usually the smaller pattern the way I set it up, and that's where I catch most of my fish, on that smaller fly. And
Isn't that also riding up in the water a little bit more, in the water column, than the heavier one, so?
Not It could be. Well, you know, that it makes sense that it would be a bit. I do put split shot between the two flies when I've got a multiple rig, as well as split shot above the lead fly or the upper fly. So I like to have the weight distributed along the leader between the flies as well as above the fly, the first fly. So I hope in my mind that that trailing fly, the smaller one, is getting down as close to the bottom as possible as well. But certainly not always true, I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I
don't know. It's hard to say the answer to that question specifically, but I think from my experience, I think the first fly catches their attention and then they grab the trailing flies and they're also the smaller ones.
Okay, I'm going to read off Eric Steele's question here.
Oh, yeah, I
probably
see.
Answer Anthony from Half Moon Bay's question as well.
Right.
With Rick, I've seen several different setups for tandem nymph rigs from various guides, books, friends, seminars, etc. Some put a weight above the flies. Others place a weight between the flies. And some use weighted nymphs. Some tie the dropper to the hook bend. Others use a barrel or blood knot or the tail from a double surgeon's knot. I have seen some use a butterfly knot to rig a dropper close to the line and the use of tippet rings. Plenty of options and ideas. What do you think works best and when? Specifically, can you describe your favorite setup for rigging multiple flies, including knots, type of location, and weight, and the different kinds of weight? Because you've described kind of your rig almost totally, so why don't you finish it out as to
yeah.
What you're looking for here.
Yeah, let me talk about my favorite setup. And, you know, this is a lot of personal preference when it comes to setting up, you know, how you're going to rig for nymphing. And it'll vary potentially on the type of water you're fishing. You know, someone on the East Coast or in New York has different size streams and velocity of water than what we might be fishing here. But my rig is going to be a straight section of 3X tippet from my fly line down to where I tie on the first fly. And that might be 6 or 7 feet long. And so I'm not using a tapered leader. I'm just going to use a straight section of 3X tippet. And then I'll tie on the first fly. And that first fly might be a caddis nymph or a stonefly nymph, depending on what I think's best. And it'll be the bigger of the two. But the bigger one might be, if it's a stonefly, yeah, it might be an 8. But it'll often be a size 12 or something in that size. And then I'm going to tie off the bend of that hook my dropper leader. And that'll either be a 4X or 5X tippet, depending on the size of the final fly I'm putting on. If it's a size 18, it'll probably be like 5X. If it's 16 or, you know, something like that, I'll put on 4X. And that tippet will be about 20 inches long, 18, 20, something like that, that dropper. And then I'm going to put a split shot between those two flies, almost right in the middle. So it's going to be about 10 inches up from the bottom fly and about 10 inches below the first fly. And I'm also going to have a split shot above the very first fly, and that's going to be about 8 inches above that fly. And then I'm going to have a strike indicator above both those flies set at about twice the depth of the water from my first fly. And that'll be the rig that I use consistently for nymphing. The nice thing about the 3X tippet without using a tapered leader is it sinks more quickly. And, you know, if you want to use fluorocarbon, I don't typically do that just because it's expensive leader material. Fluorocarbon is great, though, because it sinks quicker and it is less visible. In spring creeks, I'll go to fluorocarbon. But most of the time, if it's water that's moving fairly quickly or it's got a little riffle to it, I haven't found it that critical. But that's my basic rig. I do like, he mentions tippet rings, and if you don't want to tie your dropper off to the bend of your first fly, the hook bend, I like tippet rings. Those work really nice. It keeps your flies from tangling a bit, and I think if you're using like a rig with three flies, using a tippet rings to tie little short droppers off that tippet ring so you don't have to tie your other flies off the bend of the hook can be a good way to go. And if you're using flies that are too small to really effectively tie off the bend of the hook, like if you're putting a 16 on there, fishing to like a 16 and an 18, you can't really tie off the bend of a hook of a size 16. So using something like a tippet ring can work well.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. See, this is from Mike in Alexandria, Virginia. He writes in, the depth of a stream changes, so estimating how far to put a dropper behind a, and he's talking about a dry fly, accordingly. I wonder if there's a quick and easy way to change the dropper to dry distance without cutting or retying. So he's talking about a dry dropper.
Yeah. So when I'm fishing a tandem rig with a dry fly and a dropper, I'm usually not trying to get that nymph that's on the dropper to the bottom. I'm usually doing that in a situation where there's some insects emerging and the majority of fish are not taking dries. They're taking subsurface, but they're taking like a caddis pupa subsurface or a mayfly nymph swimming to the surface below the surface. And so I'm going to put on a dry fly that could take fish, but then below that I'm going to have a dropper on again that's probably as short as 15 inches, but usually it's going to be 20, 24 inches, depending on the depth of the water. But I'm not really trying to get that fly to the bottom, because normally you can't put a split shot on that leader without sinking your dry fly. So you just aren't going to get that nymph very deep in most cases. So that's a little different. So I'm not usually worried about adjusting the length of that dropper from my dry fly very much. I just want it to kind of drift in the zone where those fish are intercepting those insects coming up off the bottom. And I might change it a little bit, but normally 20 inches, 22 inches is about right. Same with the hopper dropper, you know, you're putting that dropper on below a hopper pattern because you expect maybe some fish to take the hopper, but a lot of those fish will be hanging down looking to intercept some bugs coming up to the surface. So that's my approach to fishing the dry fly with a dropper.
Okay.
And as far as is there an easy way to change that distance without cutting or retying, I'd offhand say no. I think you're going to have to, if you want to change the length of that dropper, you're going to need to cut it and retie it.
Yeah. Okay, need to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about indicators. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Haefeli about the most common nymph fishing mistakes. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, indicators. First question up, Lee in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. I rarely use a strike indicator. Am I really missing fish?
Yep, I think we are, even when we're using indicators, as I mentioned in that scenario where I had my wetsuit on. I know with Czech nymphing and some of the European nymphing techniques that are real popular now, they don't use indicators, and they are extremely effective. But what they all do is they have tight, what I would refer to as tight line nymphing. And so when you're in the drift and your fly is moving in the water, you're holding the line with your rod tip in a way that you have a tight connection of feel between the tip of your rod and your nymph pattern. You don't have any slack on the water of leader or fly line. And so that would be tight line nymphing. And those techniques, if they're not using, you know, some of the European methods use the little coil, getting what they call now, but the little coil indicator on the surface, that's an indicator. So if you're not using an indicator, I think you really need to be doing tight line nymphing to have a chance at detecting strikes. And when you're tight line nymphing, it is very effective to feel strikes. And that's why the Czech nymphing is very, very effective, because you do have that tight line connection between your rod tip and your nymph. And you'll feel your nymph touch rocks, you'll feel it drifting along, and you'll feel every little tick or movement or any fish that comes up and grabs it, you can feel it. So that's effective, but you gotta learn that technique to make sure you don't have that slack in your system anywhere between your tip and the fly pattern.
I think that kind of answers Rod's question from Portland about making the change away from the strike indicator.
Yeah. That's the key right there. You got to use the tight line. Whether you call it check nymphing or high sticking, it doesn't matter. If there's no indicator, you want to make sure you don't have that slack of leader or line on the water.
Yeah. Okay, we've got, Mark in Lansing, Michigan wants to know if the color of the indicator makes any difference.
Oh, that's a great question, and I would say it makes a difference to the angler, but not much of any difference to the fish. And so by that I mean is the lighting conditions change through the day. You're going to find that one color of indicator is easier for you to see versus another. So normally I use an orange or a red indicator, but there are times when a white indicator is much easier to see, and there are actually some times, like right at dusk, where you might see a black indicator easier than any other color. So just go with the color that's easiest. Bright fluorescent green is the easiest thing for you to see. Use that. So whatever is easiest, but it will change. You'll notice if you fish at different light conditions through the day, different weather conditions, one color might be easier to see than another. Depending on the reflection you're getting, the direction of the sunlight is a big part of that. You know, the kind of reflection you're getting off the water. So that's what comes to mind there. So yeah, it is good to keep that in mind.
Shane in Phoenix, Arizona wrote in and he said, "The placement of the strike indicator has been my nemesis since I started in this sport. The most common approach we hear is placing the indicator above the top fly about 3 times the depth of the water, but there are so many other factors that can skew this basic approach when trying to get the flies down to the zone, i.e. the weight of the nymph, the current, speed, etc. Will you please walk us through the most common scenarios we may face in any given river and the best approach to determine the correct placement and possible adjustments to the indicator for each scenario?"
Okay, sort of a complicated question to answer, but I'll try to come up with something simpler. Basically, in slower water, slower moving current, you're going to want the indicator closer to your flies than you're going to want them further from the flies as you move into faster water of the same depth. So if you're fishing in 4 feet deep water where it's a smooth flowing, relatively slow spring creek or just low gradient section of the stream, you may put that indicator 5 feet away. You only need it, you know, barely deeper than the water you're fishing. But if you're in faster water, you're going to need that indicator probably 8 or 10 feet away, maybe even a little further. So that's because, obviously, the current is moving things at a different pace from the bottom compared to the surface, and that difference between the bottom and the surface becomes more significant as you go into faster currents. What you're shooting for is maintaining your flies on the bottom without putting any slack in the leader between your indicator and the nymphs. So that's your objective, is to get enough distance between your indicators so your flies can reach the bottom, but you don't want any slack in that tippet between your indicator and flies, because if there's any slack in there, your indicator's not going to move when you get strikes. So usually it's probably better to err. I mean, you just have to play with it. If your flies aren't hitting the bottom and your indicator's not being pulled under, you probably don't have enough weight on your nymphs. But if your flies are not hitting the bottom but you see your indicator getting kind of pulled a little bit below the surface, that's a good indication you need to increase the distance between your flies and your indicator. The only way to do it is to gain a little experience and play with it and try different distances in the section of stream and see what you think. But you want to avoid slack, and you want enough to get your flies down.
Okay. Terry Little in Fort Collins, Colorado, asks, "What type and size of indicator do you find yourself using most often?" And he said specifically in flows 75 to 150 CFS. But why don't you expand that to, you know, what kind of indicators you do use?
Yeah. I've become a thingamabobber fan. I like them. What I want in an indicator is, and I don't like big ones. Most of the time I'm using an indicator that's would be considered moderate to small in size. So maybe the biggest I get would be as big around as your thumbnail, and a lot of times I'm using, you know, indicators that are as big around as maybe one of your fingernails on your other hand, you know, your index finger or something. So I don't like big indicators because I just don't want a lot of wind resistance when I'm casting. The other thing I want with an indicator is to be able to move it up and down the leader to change that distance easily. So I also like to use the little corkies with just a toothpick in the hole to hold it in place. Or I'll use those indicators, they're wood or sometimes little foam ones that have the slot with the rubber in the slot that holds your leader in place. And so you can move those easily on your leader to change the distance. A friend of mine uses a piece of foam that's about 2 inches long and maybe 1/4 inch in diameter. And he takes a needle and he threads his leader through that with a needle, and then he can slide that up and down, and there's always enough resistance to hold it in place. And that's an effective way to do it. It's just a little more, you know, time to set up at home, get them ready to go. But anyway, that's the size I use, thumbnail size to maybe index fingernail size, and something you can move up and down the leader a lot. And thingamabobbers are good. I like them.
Okay. See here. Gary in B.C., I think we answered your question. Rob in Ridgeway, I think we answered your question. Same with Matthew in Massachusetts. So, well, actually, Matthew, to expand upon the different river flows, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, he had one thing there. And for fast water, is there a point at which you give up on nymphing? That's more like saying, well, are there no fish where there's fast water? And I think that would be one of the decisions.
Yeah. You know,
about, right?
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that's an interesting thought, question. And I would say there's not very often a point at which I think the water's too fast for nymphing. When I'm nymphing a riffle, usually at the head end of the riffle, you get into the fastest, frothiest part of the riffle. And I'll see people stop before they get up into that real fast, frothy water because they just don't think it's holding fish. But that's sometimes where I catch my best fish, is up in that shallow, frothy, fastest little bit of water at the head of a riffle. So don't give up on water that looks like it's too fast. One of the things I've, you know, discovered from putting my snorkel and wetsuit on and crawling around in riffles and watching fish is they are so good at utilizing any little break in the current and maintaining their position in fast water. It's amazing to watch them. So don't give up. I would always be worthy of throwing a half dozen casts out there in some water that looks like it might be too fast.
Okay. DB in San Diego wrote in, he says, when you are dead drift nymphing without an indicator, if you raise your rod tip 6 inches vertical, does that translate to the flies rising 6 inches vertical? I always imagine there's a fair amount of bow in your leader and tippet by the water pushing on them, and so six inches at the rod means only a little movement of the flies vertical.
Yeah, that gets into the whole idea of how you're nymphing, and if you're using a tight line nymphing approach, raising your rod tip 6 inches is going to move your fly close to 6 inches, and it's going to vary with current speed as well. So, you know, it's not a direct one-to-one relationship, certainly, but if you're tight line nymphing and you move your rod tip 6 inches, you're moving your fly close to it. It may not come up directly 6 inches in depth, because he's right, there is going to be some bow out there in the current. Yeah.
Okay. Stephen in Ohio, what's the most common mistake made while indicator nymph fishing?
And that's not recognizing your indicator has moved when it actually has. That's the most common mistake. People don't recognize how subtle the indicator will move when a fish is taking your fly.
Right.
So that goes back to setting the hook at least once every cast when you're indicator fishing. Focus on that indicator. Don't expect anything dramatic to occur with that indicator. It's most of the time, occasionally it'll be dramatic. Most of the time it's very subtle. So don't look for a big amount of action on that indicator. Look
Ken
for something.
Ken in New Boston, Texas asks, is drag as important when fishing a nymph as it is with a dry?
Good question. So my quick answer will be not as important, but it's still important. Most of the time nymphing, I'm looking at my indicator as a dry fly, and if my indicator's drifting without drag, then I'm feeling good about things. And I'm going to usually mend upstream or downstream to avoid any sort of drag on my indicator. So, yes, I'm trying to fish without drag when I'm nymphing. I don't know for sure, you know, that the nymphs are always, you know, doing the same thing my indicator is, but I'm trying to get that sense of it by watching the indicator.
Right.
When you're doing something like check nymphing, you're actually adding some motion to your rod tip downstream slightly faster than the current. So you're trying to impart a little bit of downstream movement faster than the current on your fly. But that's really to help you detect strikes, so you know you've got tight line between your rod tip and the fly pattern. But okay. you don't want a lot of drag going on.
Hey, Michael in Dallas is asking about the differences between the European nymphing techniques. And I'm going to refer Michael to our archive where we have several shows on European nymphing techniques, because those are whole shows in themselves.
That's a big question. That sounds great.
Phil in Utah, what do you think about the dredge rig? Weight on the bottom with a large strike indicator and the use of fluorocarbon leader. You already talked about fluorocarbon, but...
I don't fish that way very often. I have a friend who really went all out with that sort of an approach, and he would catch some nice fish, but he would fish in water that was pretty darn deep, and I mean deep in a pretty good-sized river here like the Deschutes. He'd fish water that was 6-8 feet deep, and he'd put a lot of weight on. You know, Nymph Fishing for Larger Trout by Charlie Brooks gets into that. And Charlie Brooks' method, and we haven't talked about using sinking lines. And, you know, if you really are trying to get right down on the bottom in some larger streams, heavier current that's maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 feet deep, going to a sinking line, putting on plenty of weight, heavily weighted nymph, is one of the effective ways to get your flies down, and you can catch some very good-sized trout doing that. It's, you know, not a technique for those who want delicate sort of casting. This is sort of combat casting to get it out there, but it is effective, and I don't rig up that way too often, but it can be good.
Joe in New York is asking if there's any medium or long-range nymphing technique without using an indicator.
I think it's very problematic if you're going to be getting away from the rod tip very far without an indicator. Then you're not really getting that tight line conditions very easily. So as long as you can maintain some tight line connection with your nymph, sure, you can, you know, cast further out. But it gets more difficult all the time the more line on the water.
Tony in Sydney, Australia, asks, movement is considered to be a useful attribute in both design and presentation. If any wet flies, do you attempt to impart movement, i.e. to jiggle your drifting nymphs?
Most of the time I don't. And the reason for that is I'm really trying to keep them close to the bottom. And when I start imparting some action and little twitches or stuff, I'm lifting them up away from the bottom. And it's often challenging enough to get them down there and keep them there. So most of the time, that's my main objective, is getting them down close to the bottom and making sure they stay there. There are times when I know I'm imitating an insect that's moving a lot that I'll impart some action. Caddis pupa, definitely. You know, there are times where I'm going to be drifting a caddis pupa deep right along the bottom, and somewhere during the drift I'll start adding some twitches, but purposefully lifting it up off the bottom. So in that case, I'm not trying to keep it on the bottom. I'm trying to actually lift it up off the bottom and give it some action to look like a pupa that's starting to rise up. So that's the case where I definitely add some action to it. There might be a couple others if you've got some, you know, particular swimming mayfly that's really actively swimming up and hatching, where I do that. But when I'm not imitating an insect that's swimming up, then I'm usually not adding that action. I'm just letting it dead drift right off the bottom.
Okay, let's jump into some questions about flies. Rod in Portland wrote in, Rick, so you've just seen the river and found a half dozen types of aquatic insects in your net. Do you recognize some small midge larvae, swimmer nymphs, and stingers, some large, some small, some with dark wing pads, some more prevalent than others? You know you've got a trout buffet in front of you. How do you go about selecting which nymphs to tie on first?
Okay, so what I'm going to look for, and it depends on, you know, how you've gone about getting a sample there, but let's say you've done a reasonable job. I'm going to be going towards whatever is most numerous. And what's I know based on the insect's behavior what has some, like a swimming nymph over a clinger. So if the clinger nymphs are really abundant, but there's still swimmer nymphs out there, I would be more inclined to imitate the swimmer nymphs just because they're so much more prevalent in the water column than the clinger nymphs. So from an availability aspect, the swimmer nymphs are going to be better as a pattern to imitate. And also the dark wing pads, any of the insects with dark wing pads would be a top of my list, potentially pick a pattern for them. And then this goes back to changing patterns. So you're never going to be 100% sure you've got, you know, the perfect pattern on. And so, again, I'm going to have some good, clear indications of what to put on, but I might be wrong. So if I'm fishing, you know, half an hour, 35, 45 minutes, then I'll switch to one of those other flies that also looked enticing, but maybe I didn't choose the first one right off the bat. So pick one that, you know, looks mature, one that you know is available because it's an active mover, and then if that doesn't work, you know, you've got some other ideas there to choose from. But there's always going to be that trout buffet out there. And what most people do, if they're looking at that trout buffet, they see the big stonefly nymphs crawling around, and that's what they put on as a fly to imitate the big stonefly nymphs. Don't do that. Look for those little mayflies, those little midges. Those are usually much more abundant, and make sure you give them their due, because those little insects are going to be in the diet of fish much more often than the big ones.
Lee in Sandy Hook wrote in and asked, can you speak to the differences of using brass versus glass versus tungsten beads?
Yeah. There's a couple of questions here on beads, too, on color and stuff. And, you know, most often, tungsten is great just because it's heavier. So when you're setting up and you want your nymphs to sink quickly and you're using beads, a tungsten bead is good to use. And if you're in small hooks that, you know, need weight anyway, tungsten bead is not a bad choice. I don't usually use glass because I want the added weight for my nymphs. Glass are nice for certain effects, like if you make a body out of glass beads, that can be great. That can give you a really nice look, and you can use some colored beads. But when I'm putting a bead on, one of the main reasons I'm doing it is really to add some weight to it, besides some of the traction from it. So I rarely use glass beads on nymphs unless I'm putting it on the body of the nymph. So, and I probably use tungsten and brass pretty, you know, 50-50% of the time, one or the other. And color of the beads, some folks I know are saying on waters that are heavily fished that the shinier beads are becoming less effective, and they're going to dark-colored beads like gray or black, and that the shiny beads are maybe scaring the fish off, or they're learning that those bright-colored bugs out there with bright heads are not good thing to chew on, so they're going to some darker-colored beads. But I've only really run across that in really heavily fished waters. Fish do learn these things, so you might run into that.
Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington, wrote in and asked, after presentation, is color or size more important?
Size, without a question, yeah.
Okay.
Most nymphs.
Okay, go ahead. I'm trying to run through this quick on you, Rick. So.
Oh, okay. Well, just real quickly, most nymphs are going to be sort of, you know, natural colors, either grays or browns, occasionally olives, of course, but pay more attention to size than color.
Okay. Tim in La Grande, Oregon, writes, in your videos, your examples of sampling nymph populations is largely limited to rock/gravel and riffle areas. Flats are very shallow runs. Do you also routinely sample habitats of stream you'll be fishing, like weedy beds, pools, deeper and slower runs, backwaters, or mud bottoms?
So certainly weedy bed areas can be good to sample. I try to be a little gentle in those because you don't want to wade out and muck up a lot of aquatic plants and see them drifting downstream, because you're really destroying some habitat doing that. So I'm pretty gentle if I take some samples out of weed beds. Just kind of, you know, dip the net into them and don't do a lot of kicking. The deeper water is problematic just because you're going to get wet sampling in pools and stuff. The other reason that sampling in the riffles and the shallower, faster water makes sense, though, is that's the dominant food-producing areas of streams. Now, there are natural streams out there without riffles, so I'm not talking about those situations. But in streams with riffles and runs and pools, the riffles are the one areas that produce the most insect life, has the greatest diversity of insect life, and it's also the nymphs that are drifting downstream into those pools are usually the nymphs that are living in the riffles that have gotten in the drift and then have, you know, floated on down into the pool itself. So by sampling those riffle areas, you're really getting the best idea of what's out there for fish to eat. And so you don't need to worry as much about what's in the pools.
Tim also asked another question. He says, when fishing a length of stream, for instance, covering 5 to 10 stream miles, at what intervals of distance would you feel you need to resample to understand what nymphs are present? It's an interesting question.
If the habitat is changing, you know, this is a little tricky to, you know, be very specific about, but if you're seeing habitat change, like the stream gradient changes a bit, or the substrate has changed, if it's gone, there's a section of a stream here called the Metolius River. It's a big spring creek, but it's got fast current through a lot of it. The upper section is small gravel, you know, golf ball size to baseball size gravel. And then you go down about 5 miles and it changes. And then you get into some real cobble, you know, more bowling ball, softball to bowling ball size. The insect life changes significantly between those two sections, and it's because the substrate size has changed. So if you go to different substrate sizes, you're going to see some different insect life or combinations of insects in that. So sometimes I'll do it within a half a mile. I'll resample because I'm in a slightly different kind of habitat. The substrate's a little different. Current speed's a little different. Other times it might be 2 or 3 miles. And everything looks the same and everything's going to be about the same. So I'm looking really carefully at kind of substrate conditions and the current speed to think about when those insects conditions change as well.
Also, just what hatches are going on. I know over there on the Roaring Fork and Frying Pan in Colorado, you know, when you're talking about the green drakes and stuff, you know, they're moving up river during the
season. Yeah.
And so 10 miles could be green drakes or no green drakes, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. Even a half a mile, you know, can do that. I mean, yeah, for sure. So you're always looking at, you want to be paying attention to what's flying around, and that can change, that can change frequently.
I think you kind of answered this in different ways, but I want to give Rob credit here. He's over in Afghanistan asking a question. If you're searching uncommon water with nymphs, is it a good tactic to go with a large nymph and get their attention and then a smaller, more representative nymph to get them to take?
I think that is a good approach. But by large, you know, different people, you know, might have different opinions of what large means. I usually, you know, if I'm just searching, here's kind of my searching rig. If I'm in a piece of water, of course, I'm fishing western streams, which most of the time, which have, you know, some characteristics of insects, but most of the time if I'm searching, I'm going to put a size 10 or 8 stonefly nymph, dark colored stonefly nymph on first, and then a dropper with a size, usually a 16 small mayfly nymph. That's a very typical searching one when I'm not sure what to use or have no better reason. The other approach would be instead of that stonefly nymph, I'll put like a size 12 green rockworm, a green caddis nymph pattern on. And then a small size 16 or 18 mayfly. So that would be my other real common one to go with. But I think that is a logical approach to put a relatively large nymph on first and then a small one that's more imitative behind it. But just remember, change patterns if it's not working. Give that a shot, but if it's not working, then start, you know, doing something different.
Okay, I think pretty much looking at all, Rick, I'm looking at all the terminal tackle questions, which I think you kind of addressed in your describing your rig setup.
One thing I haven't mentioned that come up is the type of knot that I use.
Right.
And I use a Duncan loop knot for tying on my nymph patterns, or a non-slip mono loop knot. There's an Orvis loop knot. So pick a loop knot that you like to tie. The Duncan loop obviously will slip down and close up the loop if, you know, at times, so that's one drawback against it, but it's a knot I find easy to tie. But yes, a loop knot of your choice is, I think, definitely a good way to go when you tie on nymphs.
And there is one question here. Walt Cole in Redding, California says, if you're fishing the Green River for large rainbows and using a size 22 midge, considering the hook size and the size of the fish, what size tippet are you going to use?
Well, I'd probably, if I could, I'd probably go with a 5X. That may be a little dicey with a 22, but if you can get it through the eye of the hook, I'd probably go with 5X because there are large fish in the green. And maybe you'd want to use, you know, 5X fluorocarbon. The green's pretty clear if you're there at certain times of the year, and those fish get fished over a lot. So you might want to go with 5X fluorocarbon. But you may have to go to 6X if it's not working out too easily with 5X. Basically, you want to go with the heaviest tippet you can get away with and still get it through the eye of the hook. 4X is not going to work with a size 22.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we've got some questions on weight, and we did talk a little bit about this, but let's dig in a little bit deeper. I do have a question online here from Treg in Moscow, Idaho. He says, when you put split shot between two flies, as you do in your rig, how do you keep the shot from sliding to the bottom fly?
Yeah, you know, this comes up often. I get asked, geez, my split shot always slides down. I use tin shot because you don't want to use lead. That's not good these days, or never was. But anyway, so you can get tin shot easily. And the key that I would point to is you don't want to squeeze it too hard. A lot of people, when they have their split shot start sliding, they start squeezing harder and harder to stick it on their leader. And there was a question in there also about someone's tippet breaking near where they squeezed the split shot on. And I think that's the result of squeezing too hard, so they're really damaging the leader. So I give it just a firm squeeze shut, and that's it. I don't press real hard. And I rarely have my split shot fall down. Now, the other reason I probably don't have it fall down that often is I'm not usually doing much back casting. I'm usually just doing a roll cast up and across. I do very little false casting when I'm nymphing. And so if you're, you know, false casting like you have a dry fly on, that's going to be much more problematic in having a split shot move on you than if you're doing very little false cast and a lot of roll casts. So that's
good
the other
point.
Issue.
Yeah, because if you're following your techniques, from what I've gathered tonight, is you're fishing with short line. You're not doing 30-foot casts out there to get to some, you know, seam. You're getting on top of the fish, which means you can do the roll casts and stay right on top of them and not do all that back casting. So that all makes sense. Yeah. Rod in Portland, Oregon wrote in, he says, how do you go about determining the amount of weight to put on your leader, or do you weight your nymphs differently? Do you do anything like a different thread color to differentiate your nymphs or indicate those that are weighted versus those that are not? So do you use weighted flies, and do you?
Almost all my nymphs have some weight on them. Either if they're small flies, it might be a bead head. When I get down into 18s, those patterns usually aren't weighted because I don't want the weight to make the nymphs too fat. I want to keep them in proportion. So my little flies usually aren't weighted, 18s and 20s. But, you know, I've always thought I should put colored thread on the heads for some of the different weights that I put on nymphs, but I never have gotten that organized with my tying, so I don't do it. And I just try to adjust the weight when I'm out on the stream fishing. I know that, you know, most of my flies, nymphs have some weight on them. And when I put them on and I put a split shot on, if I'm not ticking the bottom, I add more split shot. And if I am hitting the bottom every other cast, I take a little split shot off. So that's really as simple as I can make it, is just kind of, and, you know, then you put multiple flies on. You don't always know how, you know, they're going to sink in different current speeds. So I'm usually paying close attention to that by adjusting the amount of split shot I have on.
We had a couple of questions, one online, one that came in earlier. Mark in Bend, Oregon, and Camillo in Westford asking about rods. Do you have any preferences on rods? And as Mark had asked, you know, is a Sage ESN worth the extra dollars compared to the lower price nymphing rod? What do you look for in a nymphing rod?
I'm not, you know, that specific rod, but what I look for in a nymphing rod, and I'll get disagreement on this because I've had discussions with people that do a lot of nymph fishing, I like a slow action rod for nymphing. And a slow action graphite rod isn't all that slow in reality, but I like to find a graphite rod that's slower as opposed to faster. And some of the newer, it seems like every year the newer models of graphite's faster rods all the time. And so I've got some older rods, graphite rods, that I really like for nymphing because they're more of a slow action. My favorite rod is 9 feet or 9.5 feet. I've got a couple of, I got a 6-weight that's 9 feet long that's a slow action that I really like a lot. I'll use a 5-weight often for nymphing too if it's, you know, I'm not throwing big flies, which usually I'm not. So 5 or 6-weight rods work really well for me. And I would say 8.5 is fine, but I like, you want a little longer. If you're fishing small streams, which in many parts of the country you are, then certainly you don't need as long a rod. 8 feet is fine, but usually, you know, you want a little bit of length with your rod so you can lift the fly line off the water. Essentially what you're trying to do is, you know, you're making short casts, but you still want to be able to, you know, get that slack out of any line that's on the water. So the longer rod, that's easier to do. So 9, 9.5 feet is a great length for a lot of nymphing.
Okay, great. Well, we've run out of time, and we really raced through those questions, but we got through just about all of them, Rick. So there were still some coming in online, but I gave preference, sorry, folks, to the ones that were sent in before the show started. So sorry we didn't get to all of them, but I think we did a darn good job.
Well, great questions, and I really appreciate the interest of folks out there. And nymphing is just, I think, a great mystery to solve, and it's one of the reasons I think it's so darn fun.
Yeah. Well, let's need to close things up here, but we are going to do our giveaways. We've got that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal from Amato Books, and that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and, of course, a copy of Rick's book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers and Streams from Stackpole. So hang tight with us. We're going to do a couple giveaways here, and we'll be right back. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and support network, which in turn renews their spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you didn't register for the show yet tonight, it's too late, but you'll want to make sure that you do so for the future shows so you don't miss out on winning one of these great prizes. The first thing that we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which you can find out more about at fedflyfishers.org. And it's a great organization to support and be part of. And if you're not a member, you're going to love this prize. And our winner for that is David McPeak. David McPeak in New York. And so congratulations, David. And we will notify you by email on how to collect this prize. My computer is, I know, I think we're having some problems out there on our server tonight. I noticed a lot of slowness and some comments about that. So sorry about that. I'm going to find out what's going on about that right after. Anyway, it's making my selection process here a little slow. So while that's thinking, I am going to move to giving away Rick's book, and we'll come back to giving away the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, but we'll give away Rick's book, Nymph Fishing, Rivers and Streams by Stackpole, and a wonderful book. Now you have to fill out that form on our homepage. I'm hoping you can get to it, and give me your answer. It's going to be a two-part question again tonight. And the question is this. This is actually, okay, listen carefully. The first part is, what kind of indicator did Rick prefer, particular type of indicator? And the second is, when Rick is using a searching patterns, what are the two flies or types of flies he's using to do his tandem rig for a searching pattern? So that's your, there's actually three answers there, but two questions. And I'm checking this thing here. Don't think this is it, but I'll give you the answer here, Rick. I need you to help me out. Thingamabobber, I think that's correct. But
yep.
Then right? Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
And but the flies he's got here are hare's ear and caddis nymph.
Yeah, I mean, I said caddis and a small mayfly nymph, or a stonefly and a small mayfly nymph. So hare's ear is a mayfly nymph.
Okay, are you taking that one?
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Okay. But Treg, you won his book, so congratulations. And you know the routine there, Treg, so send me your address again so that I have it. I know you've sent it before because I know Treg's won things before. So send that in, and we'll get that book sent off to you from Stackpole, and I know you'll love it. It's a great book. And congratulations on that. Let me go back here and look at still having some issues out here. On a second here. Give me a second here so I can give away this other and be done with this. There's definitely something going on our server problems. Okay, let's see. Okay, so the other gift we're giving away is Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at Amato Books. And so check that out as well as all their other publications that they have. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at all that's available out there. And it looks like our winner there is Christopher Martino. Christopher Martino in New Jersey. So congratulations, Christopher. And I know you'll enjoy that subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal by Amato Books. So congrats on that. Congrats to everybody that won tonight. Hey, Rick, I really appreciate you being on the show with us. I know we got off to a rough start here, but we just cruised through the rest of it and made it all happen. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Roger, for having me back. I really appreciate it. So, pleasure.
We enjoyed it, and thanks for sharing all your great knowledge. It's been fun. Our next broadcast.
I've got to run to a meeting, so I'm going to
okay.
Head off.
All righty. Take care.
Thanks,
everybody,
Roger.
Our next broadcast will be on September 18th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to be interviewing Phil Rowley. And our topic for that show will be Advanced Chronomid Techniques. Phil goes beyond the basics strike indicator chronomid techniques and explores techniques and setups for deep water indicator fishing, the dry line long leader technique, better known as the naked technique, and sinking lines, including dangling, where they fish straight up below the boat, where the takes on the dangling are just heart-stopping. So join us on that one. It should be a great show. We'd also like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'd be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.